We'll do it live!
You are listening to the AMC Report with your host, Ryan Dawson.
Hello everyone, this is Ryan Dawson on Anti-Neocons, the ANC Report. And with me today is Veronica Clark. She has so many books that I'm just going to link to her Amazon page below. She has a master's degree in military history, and we will be debunking some common World War II myths today. Veronica, thank you for coming on to the show. I'm looking forward to talking to you.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
I want to get into some myths about World War II, and I'd like to start with one that is often repeated by old Melonhead, and that's that the Reichstag fire was a false flag. And I'm not saying there aren't false flags categorically. I'm saying this one wasn't. But they say the Reichstag fire was a false flag to get the Nazis to invade Poland, which I think is a little silly considering it was the fourth fire in a set of fires. But I'd like your two cents on that.
That's right. And the first thing I always start with is, why would Hitler wait until he's already in power to have this fire that's supposedly being used to get him into power, right? And to have dictatorial, you know, power over the people and to engage in terror against the entire states. The fire did not take place until February 27th. Hitler was, of course, appointed by Hindenburg, lawfully, legally, quote-unquote, elected in January. So that's the first thing I usually ask people. The second thing is that Marinus van der Lubbe did, in fact, act on his own and had set several fires for that day. Now, the reason...
This is a Dutch communist.
Exactly. Yeah. The young Dutch communist, Marinus van der Lubbe. And, of course, what was he doing in Germany, right? He came there to look for work. Well, he ended up becoming a quote-unquote revolutionary. Now, historian Ingrid Beckert has talked about how he was influenced by an organization called LICA, or L-I-C-A. Those people had also apparently made contact and influenced the young Jew, David Frankfurter, in the 1936 assassination of Wilhelm Gustloff, who was a National Socialist leader in Switzerland. And of course, Lika was also behind Herschel Greenspan, who initiated the Kristallnacht riots. He was the young Jew who assassinated Ernst von Rath. So all of these things are connected, and they're connected through this Moro Giafari and Lika. But just getting back to Marinus here, who also had connections or ties to Lika. This had actually been the fourth fire he set that day, and he said he was trying to initiate the communist revolution, that the Communist Party itself was not getting underway. The reason nobody focuses on those other fires is because the communists hooked on to the Reichstag fire in particular to politicize it and to use this against the Nazis coming into power. They were trying to discredit Hitler. And it was the communists who, in fact, said that the National Socialists were behind it. And that was Willy Munzenberger's Brown Books. Those are the Brown Books that came out trying to implicate the Nazis in this. Basically, both sides politicized this event. And, you know, the communists blame the National Socialists. National Socialists blame the communists. The official trial that took place over this fire and condemned Marinus as the sole arson exonerated the Nazis and the communists both. And as a matter of fact, one of the Comintern communists who was being implicated in this fire as being like an accomplice, he was exonerated and defended by a Nazi attorney, by a National Socialist attorney. So, you know, both sides were trying to get the jump on the other. Hitler, of course, could not believe that the KPD, the Communist Party, was just going to sit back and let him come into power legally and lawfully. He was certain this was the beginning of something bigger, some kind of mass resistance. But of course, it wasn't. Now, everybody likes to refer to the Reichstag fire decree that came up after the fact. First of all, that was not Hitler's idea. That was Grauert's idea. And number two, Hindenburg and Heinrich Brüning had both been ruling by decree long before Hitler came into power. This was actually a traditional part of the German political culture. So Hitler didn't do anything that was out of the norm. And the Reichstag fire decree was very rarely used. The only people that were really affected by it were the communists, these Communist Party members, the KPD. So this idea that the fire was all about taking away human rights and terrorizing the country is, it's a complete myth. And then the Enabling Act, they like to say that the Enabling Act was also a direct result. No, the Enabling Act would have come about anyway, which Hermann Göring himself said. He said that during the trial.
Right. It's also ridiculous to say the Reichstag fire was used to invade Poland when the invasion of Poland didn't follow the Reichstag fire.
Exactly. And of course, that's usually where they bring up the Gleiwitz incident. And I've gone through that. The book I just put out is about 1,000 pages on that. There are authors who have, you know, debunked the Gleiwitz incident completely and utterly, but I found some new stuff and I've gone into it in such intensive detail that this is probably going to be the definitive end-all on the Gleiwitz incident. Okay, so it not only reveals Hitler's true intentions as far as why he really did go to war with Poland, which had to do with containment of the Soviet Union, among some other things, territorial, but what it does is it points to a circumstantial case indicting the British, who had their own radio transmitter in Polish Upper Silesia, as the ones who planted that false story. So basically what happened is the first reports of the Gleiwitz incident came out in the British press before one of those border incidents. There were in fact three. Gleiwitz was just one of them. Before they were even finished, according to the IMT trial that happened after the fact. So whoops, the British jumped the gun on that a little bit. But what you'll find is that the British report and the American Washington Times report do not match what the German press reported happened at Gleiwitz. So the thing is why would the details of this story be so vastly different if in fact something occurred there? So, you know, even if we had had a genuine false flag committed by the Nazis, you would have the same report. You wouldn't have these vast differences. So what you have is the British reporting something about an Upper Silesian Polish war, which never even existed and is not in the German White Book or the German DNA. And you all have mention of Polish regular soldiers in the British report. That is not, in fact, in the German report that was allegedly in the Völkischer Beobachter. All the Germans mention is Polish insurgents, Polish hoodlums, terrorists. That is not the case for war. Yeah. No, there is absolutely no mention of regular army soldiers by the German report. So how was Hitler going to use hoodlums attacking one little radio station as his casus belli against Poland? That's insane.
Well, it reminds me of what's happened in Ukraine with the shooting down of the commercial airliner, and that story that the gun was jumped the day before as well and blamed on Russia and yada yada. But yeah, I digress. People are still going to say Reichstag and the false flag because they don't really care about history or the truth. It just fits the narrative they're running with. But essentially, if you're going around saying the Reichstag fire was used to invade Poland, you're doing nothing but regurgitating communist propaganda.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And it was all in the Brown books. Exactly what these people say is all in Willy Münzenberger's communist Brown books. It was pure propaganda. In fact, he was the head of Agitprop.
Well, it reminds me also of like the same kind of people that always talk about the Reichstag fire being a false flag also say that Hitler took the guns, when in fact the guns had been taken prior to Hitler ever coming to power, and Hitler made the gun laws more lenient, in fact. But that's just another one. I wanted to ask you secondly about, I know how stupid this sounds, but it's something we have to tackle. The Zionists and Hitler had a secret alliance, and the Bush family and the Rothschilds financed Hitler's rise to power.
Right.
We could break that up. Well, you know, when I say Rothschilds, Rothschild, Warburg, Rockefeller, you know, the bankers, the Illuminati, whatever to go into, you know those kind of people.
Exactly.
Let's tackle this one.
Okay, well, first of all, Sidney Warburg never existed, and there are incredible errors in that little memoir that are supposed to be about the Warburg. I believe they were trying to implicate Max or something like that. So that's fraudulent. And the number one giveaway is that Sidney made the mistake of saying that Goering spoke fluent Italian. No, he didn't. As a matter of fact, the Italians had to speak German. So, you know, you're not going to make a critical error like that if these meetings really took place and you really spoke with Mr. Goering. The next thing is, I've looked into this in detail. There's no Warburgs, no Rothschilds, no Rockefellers. The only time the Rockefellers indirectly come into Hitler's financial sphere is by way of Standard Oil technical investments. And then, of course, the Warburgs through IG Farben and J.H. Stein, which was commandeered by the Nazis. So what was originally a quote-unquote Jewish bank becomes a National Socialist bank once the Nazis are in power. So, you know, what do people have to say about that? They don't account for Emil Detterding's 30 million pounds sterling that he gave to Hitler and the NSDAP because he knew that Hitler was going to be anti-communist and he hoped that eventually he would get his oil mines back from the Soviet Union that had been stolen and nationalized in some other Eastern European communist countries, such as Hungary, I believe it was. And then as far as the party getting loans, these did come through, yes. Initially, Hitler was lent money from, quote unquote, Britain or the London banks, if you will. But it was really the credit line that suddenly improved. As we know, this, you know, when you issue loans to another country, it's never like direct cash transfers or anything like that. There's always like strings attached. And this was thanks to the maneuverings, not of Hitler, but of Franz von Papen and Baron Kurt von Schröder and their syndicate of investors. And of course, this was mostly heavy industrialists. The Hamburg America Steamship Line is in there. Stein Bank of Cologne is in there. And again, that was commandeered. There's other banks, the potash industry, German oil, etc. So again, you're seeing big business, oil companies, etc., coming together and getting this money together and the support together for the NSDAP. Now, Franz von Papen had his own reasons for doing that. He thought he could kind of buy and control Hitler with his syndicate and his elites. That's not, in fact, what happened. Hitler knew what was going on there, so he really got the jump on Franz von Papen. But it's important that we see that he was the critical person in that process. It wasn't Hitler directly doing business with these people. And then we must not leave out the fact that 184 million Reichsmarks, an enormous sum at that time, was seized by Hitler and taken from the labor unions because the labor unions were all nationalized. And what Hitler ended up doing is he took that money that was largely communist and Jewish because they were the ones that were behind all the labor unions in Germany, and he made the Reich Labor Union. It was the biggest one in the world. And it, in fact, had the most progressive policies for workers. Now, Prescott Bush, of course, you know, he was just a board member, an investor in a couple of companies like Union Bank and Hamburg America Steamship Line. Simply a board member, had some investment in these companies, and he funded Hitler. It's nonsensical.
Well, I mean, the Hamburg Steamship Line went to and from Hamburg, so...
Exactly, to America and Germany, so...
Right.
Yeah, it's just a steamship, people.
And Union Credit, he's a board, he's a director on
right.
That for them, but they owned a whopping one share out of 4,000 for the Fritz Thyssen Steel Company.
Exactly.
That's not financing Hitler.
Right, and Fritz Thyssen did not give that much money. He didn't give as much as Detterding, and Detterding was Royal Dutch Shell. So, you know.
Well, the other thing is people have to realize that big companies make investments. They profit anywhere they can. And with the German miracle, I mean, the economy rising so sharply from, I mean, when you contrast where it was to what it became, a lot of people jumped in and made investments, at least before the war.
Sure.
And a lot of those ended once the war began. But people profiteer, but for themselves, it's not financing the Nazis.
Right. I mean, the only other option was to cut them off and completely isolate them and issue sanctions like we've done with North Korea. And that's not going to happen when Germany is central to not only the world economy, but Europe. There is no Europe without Germany. So that was hardly going to happen. They had to work with the man that they saw was coming into power. And of course, I always bring up the fact that Hitler was nearly shot in the 1923 putsch.
Mm-hmm.
Scheuvner Richter threw his body in front of Hitler and took that bullet. So why would Rothschild's choice be assassinated by his handlers, kind of a thing?
He was also thrown in jail.
And number two, why would you have him wait 14 years and struggle for 14 years and waste all this time to get into power if he's your choice and he's your man? As most of us are aware, Obama just kind of rose in the media overnight. I had never even heard that name until he ran for president. So yeah,
most people learned of him when he gave the commencement speech for John Kerry, and they thought, who's that guy? And he had a lot of money from Goldman Sachs and so on. But I mean, that's how American presidents are picked.
Right. And Hitler didn't get any of his real investment and funding until after he was in the saddle, not before. So they didn't buy him into power. He got into power on his own and was appointed by Hindenburg. And then the financing and the support came. So this is contrary to what most of us are told.
Plus, he printed his own money.
Absolutely. Once he was in power, he possessed the Central Bank of Germany. You can print as much fiat currency as you want as long as you're going to back it and people have faith in your bank and your state.
And he threw Baron Louis de Rothschild in prison. And even when they offered him large sums to get him out, he told them to stick it.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I think that one's been thoroughly crushed. Well, another part to that is the transfer agreement. I hear this one all the time.
And sorry to end it there. We're going to get into some more myths about World War II. However, you got to be a paying member for ANC to get that content. $5 a month or $50 a year. We also have the campaign going on right now to finance The Empire Unmasked. That is War by Deception 2. Probably the best film I've ever made. And that's ongoing right now. You can click over to that page and get some of the perks. Also, be sure to get the books by Veronica Clark, which are linked below. Thank you very much.